Welcome back to the program. In a culture in which everything is political, even the humble loaf of bread isn't spared. In fact, going all the way back to the 19th century, bread said a lot about who we were or who we wanted to be. Today, it's fair to say that that old-fashioned store-bought white bread represents the lowest rung on the literal food chain. But why has this staple that once symbolized the triumph of industrialization become so contemptible? Here to talk about this history, we're joined by my guest, Aaron Barbro Strain. He's an associate professor of politics at Whitman College in Washington. He writes and teaches on politics and the global food system, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his new book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. Aaron Barbro Strain, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. When we talk about this store-bought loaf of bread, I mean, it really goes back to this whole notion of sliced bread as being a big deal at one point.
Absolutely. Bakers didn't like to have to slice bread, but it was so popular, so wildly popular, they compared it to other 1920s trends like jazz dancing and barnstorming. If they didn't install automatic slicing machines, they'd be crushed by the competition that did. I think if you get right down to it, The sleek, streamlined loaf of sliced white bread was a symbol of modern progress, of freedom from drudgery. It was a safe, clean food in a time when many housewives were being criticized by home economists and other domestic experts for endangering the health of their families by either baking or buying unhygienic bread. Here's this thing that was engineered to look like a piece of edible modern art.
And it really was a kind of triumph of industrialization and modernity at the time.
It was. And bread was one of the later staple foods to industrialize because it was difficult to tame the unruly, slow, biological nature of dough to the rapid-fire standardized assembly line.
What happened, though, once white bread, this sliced bread, this sliced loaf, sort of became democratized?
Well, it still had these connotations because the connotations of white bread weren't just about class difference. They weren't just about status. If we look at the history of white bread, certainly that's the dominant trend. Going all the way back to the ancient Middle East, you can see that classes were marked by the shade of darkness of their bread. The lower classes ate darker bread. The higher classes ate white bread. But in the United States, white bread got tangled up with many other things, questions of patriotism, questions of race. So it wasn't just about class status. So it remained political even as it became democratized.
How did that begin to happen? How did white bread become so caught up in politics, essentially, in the cultural debates of the time?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it comes down to the physical, material fact that from, say, the 1860s all the way really until the beginning of the 1960s, Americans got between a quarter and a third of all of their daily calories from bread. So it was just a commodity that was incredibly important in the daily lives of people. So it's not surprising then that it would get tangled up in other kinds of bigger political questions.
What were some of the challenges in creating an industrialized bread model, essentially?
Well, imagine if you're Henry Ford trying to create an assembly line to build cars, but your parts grow and shrink and fall over if there's a gust of wind, and the temperature changes the size of your parts. Dough is this living biological thing that was actually quite difficult to tame to the assembly line. So that was one challenge. But by the early 1920s, engineers, scientists, chemists had overcome most of those challenges. And then the difficult thing was, how do we get people to buy this stuff? How do we get people to change their habits of baking their own bread and purchase this industrialized product? And that wasn't entirely easy either.
Talk a little bit about the marketing and advertising side of that and how the effort was constructed to get Americans, particularly American women, to do that.
I think the advertising of the day really touched on chords of anxiety and aspiration that were already in the society. I mentioned the aspirational aspect, right? The sense that this was a shining white, modern piece of edible art. There was a sense that, there was some... In fact, engineers literally designed the loaf of bread to kind of look more streamlined and more sleek so that it would be thought of as a icon of modernity. That's part of it. But the other part was playing on people's anxieties. And we see in the early 20th century, say the 1910s and early 1920s, that the fate of industrial white bread gets very much wrapped up with racial anxieties about new southern and eastern European immigrants who were coming into the country in great numbers at that time. And the native-born American population was very concerned. You know, this is the era of nativism and eugenics, things like that. And there was a sense that those southern eastern European immigrants were dirty and scary and threatening, and they ran the bakeries. So there was a lot of fear of contaminated bread, of dangerous bread, of getting sick from bread. That's very hard to separate from larger racial anxieties about immigration. So people turned to bread from these shining white factories as a way of escaping their fears of racial contamination. And it's not surprising that the factories, one of their key lines they used to advertise their bread was that this was bread that was untouched by human hands.
Right, as if that was a huge plus at the time.
It was a huge plus at the time. In fact, I have an ad from 1926 that shows these two wealthy-looking women, the kind of people who might shop at Whole Foods today, sitting around, and the caption is, "I want to know where my food comes from." Right? Very similar sentiment to what we have today. Only for them, they wanted to know that their bread didn't come from a small local bakery. They wanted to make sure that it did come from a big factory.
From a corporate perspective, who took advantage of this? What were the companies that jumped on this?
Well, the most important company, the most exciting and dramatic company certainly of the time was the Ward Baking Company, which started out actually as a small Irish immigrant bakery on the Lower East Side of New York in the 1840s, then moved to Pittsburgh where they began to become innovators in mechanization and automation of baking. And then they returned triumphantly to New York around 1910 as one of the country's largest baking companies. But that wasn't enough for them. The grandson of the founder, a man named William Ward, set out in the early 1920s to corner the whole market on bread in the United States, essentially to monopolize the entire market for bread in the country. And remember, this is the most important food at that time. And he does it through this incredible architecture of mergers and acquisitions and financial schemes that would have made Gordon Gekko proud. pretty impressive thing, and he merges all of these baking companies into ever bigger baking companies until he has three big baking companies that control almost the whole U.S. bread market, and he's about to merge them into one final giant baking company that would have been the Ward Food Products Company. And the FTC steps in and breaks it up. The FTC at the time was not really interested in breaking up monopolies. They were a fairly conservative pro-business wing of the government at the time, but they couldn't let this stand because that company would have literally set the price for the food that 90% of the country depended on three times a day for a giant piece of their subsistence.
Talk a little bit about that, how important bread was to the American diet at that point.
Sure. Well, at that point, statistics would say that at least about 90% of families ate bread three times a day. And as I said before, they got between 25 to 30% of their daily calories on average from bread. And the poorer you got, the more you relied on bread. And during times of recession or during war, the percentage could go up to 40% in terms of your getting about 40% of daily calories from bread. So there's no food today that comes anywhere close. There's no single food that comes anywhere close to providing that much of a percentage of our daily diet.
Talk a little bit about how the industrialization of bread impacted the price and the availability of bread.
Sure. Well, at first, it wasn't necessarily clear that industrial bread was cheaper. In those early years when it was an icon of abundance and progress, it was probably on par with what folks could do at home, and kind of depends on how you calculated the cost of women's unpaid labor baking the bread at home. As industrialization went on and as people lost the habit of baking at home, then certainly white bread was cheap and abundant.
Mm-hmm. The food gurus of the day, talk about how they viewed this store-bought loaf of white bread.
Yeah, and in fact, I started off writing this as a book about bread, but in many ways it became a book about all the different food gurus and diet experts and different kinds of advisors on health who believe that if they could just get Americans to eat the right bread or maybe avoid the wrong bread, it would somehow restore the physical or moral or social fabric of society. And white bread is just this great commodity, this great food through which to look at the question of how we change the food system, because so many different food gurus fought over bread. Even in the 1920s, when it was having this heyday of being seen as an icon of modern progress, there were critics lining up left and right to attack it. In the 1920s, people accused white bread of causing everything from cancer to tuberculosis to criminal insanity, rising delinquency of the youth. There are a number of eugenically minded food reformers who accused white bread of either saving the white race or destroying the white race, depending on whether they were pro-white bread or anti-white bread.
And the actual term of it as white bread, talk a little bit about that.
The way we think of white bread is a kind of adjective today.
Right, right.
We describe, you know, if music is described as white bread, we know today that, you know, it's probably funkless pablum, enjoyed in suburban cul-de-sacs. So that actually, the first real good recorded or widely cited use of that was Richard Pryor. In 1970, he storms off the stage of the Aladdin Theater, where he had this nightclub act in Las Vegas, and he says, "I'm never doing another minute of white bread humor." But actually, it goes a little bit earlier than Richard Pryor, because the counterculture of the 1960s had really made white bread a symbol of everything that was bland and corporate and suburban and chemical and plastic. Basically, everything the counterculture wanted to upend, white bread had become a symbol of that. And then what's interesting is that by the 1980s, that use of white bread as to describe kind of affluent, bland suburbia gets joined by another meaning, which is white bread describing almost the opposite, white bread describing white trash. So you can, white bread by the 1980s is kind of like broken down trailers, mm-hmm. and things like that that are used to describe or emblems of a kind of white rural poverty.
It all stands on its head by today's standards, where we look at the local baker, the local artisan, as being the apogee of where we want to get bread from.
That's right. I mean, and a point of the book that I make is that our dreams about bread have flipped completely, as you just said, right? We no longer dream of the shining white palace of industrial baking as the thing that's going to knit our communities together, save us from health threats. We look to the small local bakery. Even industrial bread now tries to look handmade, tries to, you know, get the visual appearance of handmade, even if it isn't. But I think from that vantage, we could either look back at the past and just kind of laugh and think of it as this kitschy, like, oh my God, can you believe we ever liked white bread? Or we could stop and reflect. And I think what my book tries to get us to do is to realize that in some ways, our present-day dreams about artisanal local bread saving the world are not as different from dreams of the past of industrial white bread saving the world. Today's miracle food can become tomorrow's catastrophe in many ways. And I think that the food movement today, which I'm very much a part of and very much am interested in changing the food system, making our food system better, but I think the food movement needs to reflect on some of the problems with the way we go about thinking about how food is going to save the world.
For example?
Well, we can, right now, if you look around, there are an amazing number of books out there that talk about the social, the environmental, and the health costs of our industrial food system. Everything from chemical contamination due to the heavy uses of pesticides to problems with obesity, you name it. There's books out there talking about the ways in which our industrial food system is broken, its large carbon footprint. So that's what I mean when I talk about the industrial food system being broken, in a sense, and needing to fix it. The problem that I see and what studying the history of food reform through white bread has taught me is that when food reformers focus so much on individual food choices as the way to save the world, right, this idea that what we need to do is first we need to make the right choices about food, and then we need to empower and enable other people to make those same choices, help other people get access to what we think of as good food, and that's going to save the world. When food reformers have gone down that path in the past, I've seen two things tend to happen. First, they tend to miss the root causes of the problems in the food system, what's really going on, and instead try to treat symptoms. And the second thing that happens is that very often, even the most well-meaning reformers sometimes end up reinforcing social divides between the supposedly virtuous us that does make the right decisions about food and then the pitiful, scary, in need of our help, them, who can't seem to make the right choices about food. So I think we need to move on from just focusing on individual food choices to thinking, to using food as a way to open up bigger questions about social inequality, declining wages in America, and concentration in the food system.
In a way, we're doing that, but not in a positive way, because food becomes aspirational in a certain regard, and it also, in addition to whatever the health claims may be and all the other issues surrounding local versus industrial, food has become a form of fashion.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and it's a very tricky path for the food movement to walk, and I know there are a lot of people out there who are really trying to struggle with that and think about, for example, people talk now about food justice and trying to make the food movement less elitist, and I think that's a really good direction. The problem I see from a historical perspective is that when we talk about food justice today, where it's mostly this elite us who's trying to help an underprivileged them get access to our good elite food. We're not really asking the harder questions about why people can't afford good food. Why are wages declining? Why do people not have options? I think those are the harder questions we'll be needing to ask ourselves in the future.
It's also the way that some of these trends are priced into the food, things like gluten-free, if we're talking about bread, or organic with respect to produce. I mean, these things are inherently more expensive.
Yes, and I think the hope is that as more and more demand, as more and more people are convinced that they want to buy this type of premium price food, that the premium price will fade away and the price will come down. I'm just not convinced of that, because it seems to me that the whole reason why so many consumers want to choose these foods is because they're high priced and exotic and have a kind of class status cachet, as you suggested.
And that's right. I mean, if the real price of those foods come down, something else will come along to replace it at a higher price point.
The high price of artisanal bread depends on the existence of industrial white bread. If everything was artisanal handmade bread, they wouldn't be able to charge the super high prices.
What do we find when we look at the ethnic influence on coming back to bread and what we saw in this country, you know, particularly in urban areas in the 30s and 40s, in ethnic neighborhoods, and the importance of bread in those communities?
Absolutely. My grandfather-in-law was a Jewish baker in the Bronx, and bread was the center of social life until, ironically, he was put out of work by precisely the industrialization trends that I'm talking about.
Talk a little bit about the new trends in bread that you're seeing as a result of your research and what you've done on this book.
Well, I think one of the things that comes out in my book is that the nature of our bread and our bread consumption and our desires for different kinds of bread always reflect these bigger underlying social dynamics. And the key factor I see right now in the U.S. is growing inequality. And our consumption is following the patterns of growing inequality to now where in the past, you know, in the 1950s, everyone across class lines pretty much ate the same packaged white bread. Now we have a highly segmented market, right? We have very expensive, really nice, handmade, wonderful artisanal loaves from small independent chains. We have plastic-wrapped, industrially produced whole wheat breads for another class segment. We have white bread for lower class segments. It's a very highly segmented market along class lines, and it seems to me that if our country continues to grow more and more unequal, then bread markets will simply follow that pattern and stay the same way. I don't see, for example, I don't see industrial white bread disappearing anytime soon because of the way it fits into this highly class segmented pattern of consumption in the United States. Where each niche market fits a certain class, a certain status. Mm-hmm. There's one exciting development that I think is really just the bread geek in me loves, which is places that are trying to innovate with hybrid industrial artisan techniques. There's a bakery in a big global firm called La Brea in Southern California that... originally grew out of a small artisanal bakery, but now is a multinational corporation that ships bread everywhere. But they do really interesting stuff with, for example, they have robots, these Japanese robots that mimic the delicate fingers of a village baker. And they try to respect many artisanal processes and conventions in mass producing sourdough baguettes, for example. Mm-hmm. So the bread geek in me, I don't think that's going to solve the larger problems of class inequality or anything like that, but the bread geek in me is kind of fascinated by these efforts to bridge artisanal and industrial.
As these other niches have grown up, what has it done for the total sales of white bread? Have we seen a decline?
Yes, we have. In fact, in 2009, for the first time in U.S. history, the value of whole wheat bread sales surpassed the value of white bread sales for the first time in history. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're eating more whole wheat than we're eating white bread, because whole wheat tends to be more expensive than white bread. But it is a dramatic historical shift. If you go back to the 1950s, when only about 15% or so of bread in the country was whole grain, and 85% of it was white bread, there has been a dramatic shift. And in fact, I don't know if you knew this, but Wonder Bread and its parent company have entered bankruptcy and are mm-hmm. waiting before mm-hmm. a judge right now who will tell them whether Wonder Bread is too fluffy to fail. But I think there's many issues going on in that case, but one of the issues is that there has been a shift in the nature of bread consumption.
What have we done in terms of exporting white bread around the world?
Sure. Well, if you think about this, these moments in the early 20th century that I was talking about, where white bread was seen as a symbol of progress, of freedom from drudgery, after World War II, we really went about thinking, hey, that's something we have to offer the world. This was a time when, say, the Soviets were maybe starting to outpace us in terms of military technology. We thought their education system might be better than ours. There were lots of anxieties mm-hmm. and concerns about the Soviet Union at this time. But no one in the world had an industrial food system like we did. No one could produce abundant bread, abundant food in the way we could. So there was this sense that, it's funny, you listen to the reformers, none of them thought necessarily that our bread tasted better than, say, a French bread or what you might eat in some other country. There was the sense that, yeah, our bread might taste like cardboard, but it's abundant, it's systematic, it's consistent, and it's cheap, and that is something we have to offer the world. And there was the sense that white bread and spreading industrial food to the world was a way of ensuring world peace and security in a dangerous time. So we did actually go out after World War II in different ways to try to spread America's industrial white bread habit to other countries. We tried this in occupied Japan. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, there was a sense among many occupation officials that if we could get Japan to switch its staple from rice to industrial white bread, it would help the Japanese become physically stronger and actually more democratic and more able to stand up against communism. There was this way in which our own kind of confident belief in the moral value of industrial white bread got mixed up with our notions of national security. So we thought that exporting white bread was a way to secure national security. Didn't work out so well in Japan. Obviously, rice is still the staple, although white bread is quite popular in Japan still, but just not as a staple food. We did a similar type of thing in Mexico where we really promoted white bread production through the diffusion of technology for new kinds of modern baking, also the creation of new high-yielding wheat varieties that were the perfect kind of wheat for industrialized bread processing, to be made into flour for industrialized bread processing. And that stuck in many ways. Mexico has become one of the world's leading consumers of white bread.
And the company that's the largest producer is a Mexican company.
Yes, and I just find that absolutely fascinating. How did the world's most dynamic, important producer of American-style white bread grow out of the land of corn tortillas? I just find that really fascinating. And now that company, it's called Bimbo, is buying up American bread brands left and right. So you may not know it, but you may be eating, if you buy bread at the supermarket, you may be eating Bimbo bread.
We've outsourced white bread.
Exactly.
Aaron Bobrow-Strain, his book is White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. Aaron, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff.
Appreciate
it. Great conversation.